Welcome, folks, once again to the Slowpokes podcast. As always, I am Slowpoke number two, David Chalante.
And I'm Slowpoke number one, John Nicolaitis.
And we are here today to discuss Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain.
Yes.
By legendary video game auteur.
Auteur?
Hideo Kojima.
Yes, that's correct.
I am going to be very apologetic about that because it's a big thing, is how do you pronounce his name? Is it Hideo or Hideo? I think I'm going to go with Hideo.
You mentioned that, and I don't actually know what the difference is.
Kojima, very few people seem to be upset about Kojima, so maybe we'll just go with Kojima.
Ah, Kojima-san.
But that was by Kojima Productions, unsurprisingly, late 2015, around September was when that came out. Mm-hmm. Now, Ground Zeroes, the lead-in demo-ish kind of thing, was earlier than that by a few months. I think it might have even been... Doesn't really matter. I didn't play Ground Zeroes. We're here to talk about Phantom Pain.
Ground Zeroes is literally like a two-hour prologue.
Yeah, I wouldn't even know. Didn't play it, did I?
It's so weird that they did that, but they did. Anyway, we're here to talk about the Phantom Pain.
Yeah, so I am completely new to the Metal Gear Solid series, but John, you are somewhat of a connoisseur.
I'm more of a connoisseur of the like after the two era games, so 2, 3, and 4.
To Metal Gear Solid?
Oh boy, yeah, because I didn't play the original.
There are like 15 of these.
Yeah, I didn't play the original Metal Gear games, and I didn't play Metal Gear Solid 1 because I didn't have a PS1.
Mm-hmm.
But I did play 2, 3, and 4.
And everything after that, or just the Metal Gear Solids after that?
Yeah, just the Metal Gear Solids after that.
Okay.
And I played a bit of
Peace
Walker.
So you have a solid, like, 30% of the...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, maybe, so 30 to 50% of the things that are on offer?
You've got to remember that the original ones were not as dense as they became, and none of them are as dense as four.
Yeah, and then there were, like, some on the PSP, and then there was, like, a social... It was, like, Metal Gear Solid Social or Metal Gear Social or something like that.
Now you've lost me.
I don't know. I read this all on Wikipedia. It's so beyond me. When I'm having trouble grasping even how many games are in the series, you know that you're in trouble as far as grasping the narrative of all those games.
Yep.
I've gone into this completely blind, which was very fun because it's very at odds to how I normally do things. Normally I have to at least read like a primer online or something like that to actually get into it, but I decided to go into this one completely blind. But John, as a more experienced Metal Gear Solid fan, why don't you tell our fine audience what you were expecting from the latest installment?
So, like, I was kind of expecting, like, the culmination in all of the things that Kojima was trying to do with all the earlier games.
Mm-hmm.
As the games went on, the levels were getting larger and more expansive, and it went from these fixed camera zoned kind of levels to a fully open world experience, you know, seamlessly traveling from enemy base to enemy base, sneaking your way in and stealth shooting everybody you see, regardless of who they are.
Yeah, see, I didn't have quite a detailed picture as that, but I definitely heard open world.
Yes.
Definitely heard stealth.
Yes.
And I definitely heard about quiet.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things were what I was expecting to see in this.
Oh boy, didn't we all hear about quiet?
There really is a scene where they flat out say she breathes through her skin. I thought that was a joke.
Nope.
I thought it was a joke.
Nope.
They've just like, she breathes through her skin.
Oh yeah.
It just happens. Like, they just say it like it's a totally serious thing that I was supposed to just accept.
Spoilers for the game. Turns out Quiet breathes through her skin.
Yeah. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
So I was expecting a lot of stuff about Quiet and a lot of things to maybe not be super great with her. But other than that, pretty heavy themes and a big open world. That's really all I was expecting going in. Quiet shit. Metal Gear Solid stealth shit.
Yeah.
But nothing really detailed.
Yeah, no, think about it. It was just kind of like, all my expectations was MGS, Metal Gear Solid, transplant into an open world.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because after having played the game, there's a lot, like a lot to talk about in this game that wasn't talked about, and I think it was mainly because people were just talking about how few clothes Quiet wears.
She wasn't wearing many clothes.
Yeah,
though.
And we will definitely talk about Quiet.
And there's even scenes where she wears less clothes, which is surprising that that can happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's only so naked you can get, right? But we will definitely be talking about Quiet. Why don't we probably start off with the spoiler-free stuff, though, and start with how the game looks and feels and plays.
Yeah, so I think when I was trying to sort of sum up how, like, the aesthetic style of MGS, it's like this cleaner version of Black Hawk Down, like this military movie kind of experience. But then every so often there's like the chick from The Ring turns up and like spook stuff sometimes happens.
Yeah. So like the genre conventions are kind of interesting. I remember watching something a while ago and I wish I could remember who did it. About Bollywood and the way their conception of genre is separate from the conception of genre in the West. Like, we have these very strict ideas of, like, this is a sci-fi, this is an action movie, this is a, you know, drama. But in other parts of the world, those same categories aren't experienced in the same way. And that's why when we watch a Bollywood film, we think it's really ridiculous that we have this really deep, serious high-stakes drama with musical elements in it. Or, like, in Japan, we have these blendings in a game like this of sci-fi elements and horror elements and stuff like that. So
yeah.
It's this very fun tableau of different, like, grab bags of different genres, which I think is very, very cool.
Yeah, you know, you're going to get robots.
Yeah.
Because there's robots in all these games. I think that keys in very well. It's, like, a very culturally Japanese game that's, like, inspired by the West. The original Solid Snake was actually, I can't remember if he was supposed to be Tom Cruise or there's like, you look at the original artwork.
Right.
And it was like,
cause yeah, his hair was a lot darker in that original art, whereas now he's a lot more kind of blondish.
And, I'm not sure if he's exactly named after Snake Plissken from the Escape to New York and Escape from LA.
Oh, he looks a lot like him though, doesn't he? Yeah, God, that's so obvious now that you've said that. I'm a fucking idiot.
As soon as I bring it up, you're like, oh yeah.
Yeah. How, like, admittedly, I've never seen any of the Snake Plissken movies. I know that I should, but that should have been very obvious, a link, right? How have I known who Solid Snake is for decades and not made that link before now?
And I'm going to be giving Metal Gear Solid trivia from all the games.
Yeah.
In MGS 2, his alias is Plissken.
There we go, yeah.
So, yeah, they're well aware of where the characters come from.
Yeah, they wear their references on their sleeves, which I quite like. There's a lot of very obvious intertextuality and stuff in this too that's for both for thematic reasons and aesthetic ones. I do like that they're not really burying a lot of that, because something doesn't have to be secret to be valuable. That's one of the things I find very frustrating when people are like, oh, look at all these secret things. It's like, we're allowed to be upfront with our themes. Yeah. Like,
look, over there, it's a giant robot. It's got a nuke on it. Metal Gear.
This is a metaphor for nuclear armament.
Yeah, except we put it on a robot.
So yeah, you mentioned that it has like that very like clean Black Hawk Down kind of feel.
Yeah.
They're very much going in a lot of the cinematography and stuff like that for that feeling of like the journalist on the ground, like that embedded journo in the military platoon type feel. Like, it's all handheld camera work and stuff like that.
Totally.
And it's very compelling, like super, super compelling to watch.
My thing about the Metal Gear series, it's like, it's my favorite not a movie.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Right? Especially MGS4, like, you basically watch most of that game, right? The gameplay sections are sometimes so short, you're just watching it happen.
So, yeah, you can probably find those on YouTube, right?
I actually found a 12-hour supercut of every cutscene from all of the games, and even some boss fights sewn together.
Oh, yeah, just to give you, like, a solid kind of understanding of...
Yes, a very solid understanding of the game.
Get it? I did a pun.
But it's 12 hours long.
I'm not sitting through that for 12 hours. the visual aesthetics are pretty interesting, like we said, because you're set in Afghanistan and in Africa, and so they have the iconic desert environments and stuff like that.
Yeah, I would sort of lean into the more sort of stereotypical cultural touchstones that you would kind of associate with those areas.
Yeah, you are right. They are stereotypical. It's undeniable.
Just a tad.
There's a couple of culturally appropriative elements of the game, but yeah, there's a lot of very, as you say, stereotypical imagery of, like, especially Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Africa, I can't comment on that with as much authority because I'm not as familiar with those kinds of images.
Oh, I agree. That's why I said true.
Yeah, but...
he say true, didn't... Anyway.
But yeah, like, with Afghanistan, it has all of the classic things that make you feel like you're in a Middle Eastern war zone. And for better or worse, it is quite immersive, and that ties into a lot of the stuff that I think works very well in this, that they go so much more for an emotionally evocative and emotionally grounding aesthetic palette
yeah.
than pure realism. So, like, if you compare the way this looks and the way this sounds to a game like COD, COD looks and sounds more realistic than this. Battlefield looks and sounds more realistic than this in a fidelity sense. In some of the opening cutscenes, for example, you have this gunfire in the background. And even though it doesn't have quite the same, what to me seems like realism as a gunfire soundbite might in a game like COD, it sounds so much like a war zone that I would be familiar with from like film and things like that. So it makes me as a player feel like I'm a lot more oppressed in that.
It's more cinematic.
Yeah.
Than it is simulator.
Exactly. And so that's what I'm getting at. That was my experience of it. I can't comment with any authority on the realism of these, these gun sound bites and things like that. But from the way a lot of the other sounds work as well, like when, cause it's set in the '80s, whenever you listen to like a recording of someone's voice, it's on audio cassette.
Yes.
And they have the sound of them, you know, plugging the tape in and pressing play. And it's such a like viscerally pleasant sound of that clacky plastic.
I found all the interfaced sounds to be these wonderfully satisfying noises.
Yeah, and so much of it is, right? That soundscape is so perfectly designed to, I think, make me feel immersed in that world and, like, it to evoke something in me more than it is, like, pure realism or pure fidelity.
I think that you play through the game through the eyes of Venom Snake.
Yeah.
Right? And, like, it's always kind of reminding you of that. You know, you're always following him around and, you know, it even every time you start a mission, it like zooms into his eyes to sort of remind that kind of feeling.
Which is also very nostalgic, isn't it? That was huge when first person shooters started to become a thing so that we could understand what we were looking at.
Yeah, it does feel a bit anachronistic.
Yeah.
Especially as soon as you zoom in, you basically zoom back out again.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what's that about? That's weird. I only just made that connection now that obviously most of the game is played in third person. Why are we zooming into this guy's head?
Yeah, it's just trying to remind you that you're like experiencing this through him
and through
like
his lens, and that's why.
Yeah, and that's why, like, when you run around, you can hear, like, sound, the air whooshing past his ears and things like that. It's like, grounding you in the character of Venom Snake.
Mm. It's very effective as well, because there are elements that they establish pretty early on where this isn't really spoiler territory, but because, you know, the giant piece of shrapnel that he's got coming out of his head, everyone at home?
Yeah.
You've seen the images, right? But it's established early on that that is embedded in his brain and could be causing mild hallucinations.
Yeah, that's almost
so they do set up this element of an unreliable narrator or an unreliable experience of what you're seeing. And so constantly reminding you that you are seeing it through his eyes is helpful for that. I think his eyes, he only has one, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, he has one. And also
through his eye.
Also, technically, you're like observing it through that weird Third person
version of his perspective, yeah.
Yeah, the dream version of his perspective.
The sounds are all pretty good. There are plenty of them that are sort of like non-diegetic as well that are pretty pleasing. Like, you've got a note here for the reflex time and like the alert noises when and stuff like that.
Yeah, when you get, I mean, like, Metal Gear's always had like a long history of the wing alert sounds.
Yeah.
But in this game and in Ground Zeroes, you enter reflex time, which basically gives you a second to sort of slow-mo shoot a guard to maintain your stealth.
Yeah, I fucking love that.
It is a great mechanic because it's like, A, you can easily turn it on and off in an option menu, and B, it does extend the stealth of your encounters, which just makes the game more fun.
Yeah, I really like that as well. Like, we'll jump into this a bit deeper in gameplay, but I love that this is actually a stealth game. Like, that's kind of a little bit different from what I was expecting. There's also a bunch of other sounds that they use that are a bit more subtle than that. Like, when there's a light pointed on you, you get a sort of like a tinnitus kind of whistling.
Yeah.
And then there's also, like, if there are guards nearby, the soundscape changes very slightly. And again, you can turn all of this off if you prefer to play with a higher challenge or with slightly less annoying sound bites if you find them annoying. But I think that, like, that design of using audio to keep you situationally aware is very, very elegant.
It's also kind of realistic, too. Like, I always love when I put on my surround sound, you know, headphones, and I could actually pinpoint the sounds where people were walking around.
Oh, yeah, like that. Definitely. Like, that's all great as well. But I'm talking about the sort of the out-of-universe user experience design type stuff to teach you as the player different things that you might not necessarily be aware of.
I always find that that's bridging the gap between you, the player, and the character.
Yeah.
I'm sitting in a chair right now, and I can feel that I'm sitting in a chair. When you play a game, you can't feel the environment. But anyway.
There is one element of the audio design that really gets on my nerves.
And it's a real bummer to sort of have to bring it up. But yeah. You're absolutely right.
But when you get quiet as a buddy, she will jump up on a ledge or something and just, she'll kind of give you Overwatch, right?
Yep.
And there's a bunch of cool shit that she can do. Like, if you get spotted, she'll take out the dude who spotted you and stuff like that. It's fucking sick.
There's a whole bunch of different buddies in the game, and they all do distinct things, and Quiet's Overwatch Sniper is one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, but to communicate that she has someone lined up, because she doesn't speak, hence Quiet, she'll hum a little tune over the microphone, and there are points in the cutscenes and stuff where she hums this tune, and it's kind of eerie, and it's kind of weird, and you can tell that she's humming it. When it comes over the microphone, it sounds like an electric motor, and it's it is teeth-grindingly irritating, and I didn't even get through one mission with her as my buddy before I started looking up mods to get her to stop making that humming noise when she was, because it's so unbelievably irritating.
It honestly feels like they have one sound clip for it.
Yeah, and they just repeat maybe 6 seconds long, and they just repeat it over and over and over. And it isn't like a, I've changed targets now, here's a quick little thing to let you know. It's, I have a person lined up, and I will hum.
Yeah, basically in any, whenever you're infiltrating any base, there's going to be a whole bunch of people she's targeting.
Yeah.
So she's going to be constantly humming while you're trying to sneak around.
And when I put this mod in, right, there were a whole bunch of different options for what I could do with that. All I did was make her silent where she would normally be humming.
Mm.
When she changes targets, she gives a little, she clicks on the radio anyway.
Yeah.
Because, and so I get this little ksh-ksh to hear this, to hear her move her target. I thought that was way cooler, way more like Spec Ops military style. And I didn't have to listen to this like gross electrical whirring in my ears the whole time. It blows my mind that the sound design in this game is so good, except for this, which is so, so bad.
I think the problem is because they apply like a filter over the radio comms chatter to make it seem like an old school radio, that it just turns that humming into an electrical buzzsaw.
Yeah. And when anybody talks and they have that filter, it's great.
Yeah.
But when she's humming, it's like, it took me ages to even figure out that she was even humming. Like it's, I know it's such a small thing to get so worked up about, but like I said, because the rest of the audio design is so great.
Yes.
It stands out so, so much as the only thing I had a major problem with.
All the audio, including like the music as well, is really well employed. You know, it has a classical score for like, you know, most of the scenes, but then it also has like diegetic music from that time period.
Yeah. And so like you'll go past a radio and there'll be like a Blondie song playing.
Kids in America starts playing. Mm.
And oh my God, the opening. Like I'm not going to talk too much about this opening scene because it's so fucking good, but they use the Bowie song, Man Who Stole the World. And it's the cover by the Scottish dude whose name I can't remember at the moment. And so you start off with this incredible piece of music that is thematically tied to who you are as Big Boss and all of this stuff. It's just, it's very, very powerful. And they use a lot of music quite powerfully like that, as well as just, as you say, being a cool element to remind you this is 1984.
Yeah. Quickly, just on naming vernacular.
Yeah.
The character is called Big Boss, but in the game, they establish that his code name is Venom Snake.
Yeah, and we'll be referring to him by Venom Snake for the most part.
As we go on, there may be other names we have, because we'll talk about all kinds of different snakes, because across all the games, there's Solid Snake and Naked Snake.
It's very complex, and we won't go into too much of that now, because we're still in spoiler-free territory.
But we'll try and stick with Venom Snake when we talk about him.
Yeah, good point, good point. Do we want to talk about the gameplay for a little bit?
Yeah, definitely.
So I mentioned before that it's a stealth game first and foremost. I was expecting something a little bit more like Deus Ex, where it's like choose how you play. And it's true that there is a choose how you play element of this, but I felt like the stealth was like expected to some degree. Like even if you want to build like heavy armor and rocket launchers or whatever, stealth is still the presumed starting point for every mission. Mm-hmm. I think I was very pleased by that it was such an integral part of the game and it wasn't more that 50-50 thing where they kind of half commit to a bunch of different stuff. Like, it was very well polished and I thought it was pretty strong.
The Metal Gear Solid series tagline is tactical espionage game, and that's what it's about. It's about sneaking around bases. That's the classic Metal Gear Solid way. That's the correct way to do it. The right way, in quotation marks, to play this game is no kills, full stealth.
Yeah, and there's something about that, and this is very minor, because I understand that in real life, no one can be as good at anything as Solid Snake or Venom Snake or whoever it is that you're playing as that particular game. You are still effectively superheroes like you are in every video game, but believing that you're an awesome spy who sneaks their way through stuff rather than a gun-toting Rambo type who blasts their way through stuff, I feel like it fits more believably into the world. That most of the time you succeed not because you're bulletproof, but because you're just really good at not being spotted.
I mean, every time you get into a really tough fight anyway, you just sort of fall. The combat's great, but I feel like when you get into like a real just shooty moment, kind of becomes aware how stealth focused the game is.
Yeah, because it is less robust. Yeah. And especially some of the later enemies that have like the full body armor and stuff like that, they're just sponges and you're just shooting them over and over and over and over and over and over and over again to try and get them down.
But if you sneak up on them and you grab them from behind,
yeah,
you just choke them out.
And you can interrogate them and get info. Like, there's a lot of little things like that I just thought were so cool. Like, I can interrogate a guard to get information on other guards around here. If I'm lying down and still, you know, hold your breath and go completely still, you're much less visible than when you're moving around. And, like, they have... some of this stuff is very basic Stealth 101 stuff, but, like, how loud you are and how quickly you move feels very important and that kind of thing. And then that all ties in with, like, how super secret, gritty military you feel when you jump up in a chopper and shit like that, too. Like, there's a consistency in the way that you play that ties in with all of the aesthetic stuff we've already talked about how gritty it feels and how militaristic it feels and how, like, grounded all of that is.
No, definitely. There were a couple of things that I felt that were missing as, like, a old-school MGS fan.
Yeah.
Like, in 3 and 4, there was more of a camouflage, like choosing the right camouflage.
Yeah.
And it played into the game a little bit more, and I quite enjoyed that, but it's not... you don't feel it missing, I think.
Yeah, and especially for me, because I didn't feel that anything was missing because I didn't know what I was missing. Like, at the start of every mission, you choose your kit, and one of the things you choose is the camo that you're wearing. And so you can do urban camo if you expect to be among, like, steel and concrete, or you can choose, like, desert camo, or, like, there's, like, difference between sand and rock and greenery and marshland and all of that kind of stuff.
And there's even a stealth suit that's just for, like, nighttime.
Yeah, and so I love all of that kind of thing where the camo... I felt like the camo was deep enough, you know, and it felt like, because there were some concerns I raised about the weapon development stuff. So because you run like this base and you have like a research crew and you assign resources to them developing different weapons and things. And that's how you sort of choose how you play. The camo stuff I felt was very easy to get.
Yeah.
And I liked that I had a lot of options from the beginning, whereas the weapons... I got to the end of the game and felt like I wasn't even halfway through that weapons tree. So I felt like there was a lot of choice with that camo, and I liked that quite a lot. Again, it was just another one of those little things of like, I'm not going into battle dressed in like magenta and purple camo because I'm playing a game of COD multiplayer or Chrome Hounds or whatever. I pick gear that's appropriate to the mission and makes me blend in because it has a gameplay benefit. I liked that.
And the Metal Gear games have always been peppered with those little details and like little tricks that you learn when you get better and better at playing the game. Like, I think in this one, you can slide around in the box and things like that.
Yeah, if you upgrade the box, you can move around slightly a little bit if you want.
But there's like these tiny little details that you can use to your advantage, and like you can string together combos for CQC when you get in close quarters.
Yeah, CQC is it's close quarters combat. It's the melee system.
Yeah. Something that was really pronounced in MGS3 that they kind of, again, simplified into something that's, I think, works really well for the open world kind of design. It's just a very basic punch combo system
yeah.
that you can chain into multiple yeah. Enemies
yeah.
to stun like a whole group of people. Mm. Like Snake can just drop into a crowd, just punch them all up.
Yeah.
And just
and like there's also if you don't want to go that full punchy thing, you can just sneak up behind people and take them out one at a time. If there's like a patrol of three guys in a line, you can be sneaky and get them all. And I like that you can hold people up as well. That was a very cool touch.
Yeah.
Which is not as effective as like actually grabbing a hold of them so they can't move, but you can still stick someone up and say, don't move, tell me where the bomb is or whatever. The other thing I really like is you choose when you drop in to a mission. So you can choose to drop in at dawn or at dusk or right now.
Yeah.
And for me, it blows my mind that anybody would choose daytime. Maybe.
Oh yeah.
Because maybe I was just lucky and got very few night vision goggles, but whenever I had a mission during the day, it was next to impossible to sneak around.
Also, I'm so used to old school MGS. I just expect enemies to see me. So I'm always trying to block line of sight anyway.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So like it didn't even bother me that much that sometimes guards would have night vision goggles. And also the game, cause the night vision goggles glow red, it cues you in.
Yeah.
It wants you to look at enemies and see what they're wearing and how they look and how they act.
The binoculars were a lot of fun as well. So you have this like intelligent scope thing that you can use to tag all your enemies. So before you go into a base, you can get to a high point, scope it all out. And again, it just feels very much like I'm being a tactical military person. I am getting information first. When you're looking through the scope at something, you just tap left trigger and Ocelot gives you information on what you're talking about. So it feels like you actually have like a support team behind you.
And it's contextual depending on what you're looking at. Exactly. I think that's like the most important part. You'll be looking at, you look at a gun or an antenna or what have you, and sometimes he'll have a unique thing to say about it, which I found just wonderful. And also, in speaking about marking things, we mentioned it briefly before, but the buddy system and like who you can bring in, it's such a cool little companion you can have in this open world.
Yeah.
The game starts with, you get D-Horse, Diamond Horse.
I guess D stands for diamond,
yes.
Right? Yeah. You're the Diamond Dogs is your military company.
Yeah.
Your mercenary company, I should say.
And so the first buddy you get is Diamond Horse, D-Horse. And it's basically like this... It gives you this ability to sort of stealth travel across the map.
Yeah, because traveling on horseback is a lot less obvious than traveling by car.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can call the horse and make the horse wait and that kind of thing too with different commands. And you've got D-Dog, who's your first sort of like full tactical buddy more than a transport system. And D-Dog can like, you can order them to bark or you can order them to stay. And you can upgrade them with different kits so that they can like attack an enemy and stun them or attack an enemy and kill them. And all that kind of stuff.
I mean,
so there's a lot you can do with the buddy.
And like in D-Dog even detects enemies for you when they enter a certain range.
Yes, that's amazing. Yeah. And you can upgrade that as well. Like you can buy something for D-Dog to increase their, or maybe their bond level increases their range or something. But they're super useful. Quiet, as we've already mentioned, she'll jump up on a ledge and like spot enemies. And if you get spotted and don't take them out by the end of reflex, she'll take them out at the end of your reflex for you if she can get a clean shot. And
also, when you build up your bond level with her, you can just say, cover me. And she'll just start shooting everybody.
Yeah, and so she's very good at like running interference and that kind of thing.
And I like how the AI behaves in this game too. It's very basic stuff, but like when Quiet starts firing, they'll call in that there's a sniper.
Yes, that's the other thing too. The whole they'll call into home base, and if you take out the comm system first, they can't call reinforcements.
Yep.
Or you can like take out the lights. If you go to the power grid and switch the lights off, someone will come and investigate that the lights are out. And if you get them before they radio in that there's been interference, that call doesn't go back through, and none of the other guards know about it. And then you've got C4, which is the most badass thing.
My favorite thing to do in a mission is like stealth into a base at night, plant C4 on the radar, the anti-air radar, which prevents your helicopter from coming in close, and on the AA guns, maybe on the radios if I can. Stealth in, rescue a prisoner, and then on the way out, just blow all the C4 and get into that helicopter.
Good. I love it. Like, one of my things was that if I found the power grid, I'd put a block of C4 in it, because most of the time I'd leave them on because I didn't want the guards to know that there was a thing. But you put the block of C4 in it, and if somebody spots me or somebody calls it in, I just like, and all the lights go out in the base. It just, you just feel like you're such an elite operative when stuff like that happens. Yeah. And that's the big theme that you're probably all noticing from what in the gameplay made me really, where it really resonated with me is that how much of it really feeds into that image of Venom Snake as this
legendary soldier.
Legendary soldier, yeah.
And he's that you're the boss
on the ground and you're like in the dirt and in the mud and doing the dirty espionage work. It creates that sense of you as a soldier very, very well.
And honestly, as an MGS fan, it's a perfect culmination of like the entire series to me. You know, it has the CQC, it has the stealth, it has the weapons, it has all of these different elements. And in this game, it tweaks them to just the right amount where it's just like, you get to do all of it. And you're like, it's just this nice buffet. And
yeah, I thought it was really well balanced. And like, personally, obviously, I can't speak from the experience to compare to other games, but this, it felt really good.
The only thing that really bugs me, and then I feel the other Metal Gear Solid games did a way better job of, was kind of the boss fights.
Yeah, yeah. So there aren't that many in this, but it falls into that exact same problem that some of the more recent Deus Exes have been criticized for. And that's that if you want to play stealth, are totally allowed to for 90% of the game and you're rewarded for playing in that way, but then they have an obligatory boss fight where you just have to go toe-to-toe with a really tough enemy.
Mm.
And if you're not used to the combat system, like I wasn't, they're fucking nightmares.
Or you have to be so good at stealth, right, that you're just... It's like the level of difficulty for the stealth is just massively high.
Oh, okay, so like...
Apparently you can stealth some of those missions.
I did not know that.
Yeah. I don't know how you do it.
Well, I mean, like...
And I don't think you can do it with all of them.
I'm going to confess to some noobishness here. There's a mission very late in the game. It's mission 45. For spoiler reasons, I won't say exactly what the mission is. But basically, you have to survive wave upon wave upon wave of tanks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you fail a couple of times, the game goes, do you want to put on the chicken hat so guys can't see you? Which I like that. I like that mechanic of the of, look, you're having a tough time. Do you want to just get through the mission?
It's the same as letting people turn on and off the reflex mode and all those other things.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like control to the players.
Yeah. And so I was having a really tough time with this mission. I put the chicken hat on.
Yep.
Enemies could still spot me. And after failing that like three or four times, they asked me if I wanted to put the little chicken hat on, which makes me literally impossible to be spotted by the enemies, and I could still be spotted by the enemies. Like,
yeah, that's weird.
It's I don't know if it was just that mission or whatever, but when you're talking about a high bar being set for some of these boss fights, it's got to be through the fucking roof if I'm at two levels deep on noob mode and still getting spotted.
Yeah, and especially as a fan of the series... There have been some really interesting boss fights. MGS 3 stands out for me with like some of the boss fights in there being interesting and unique and also involving stealth and also involving stamina takedowns.
Yeah.
In this, you can just shoot some bosses and that neutralizes them.
Yeah.
When in other games, you'd be forced to use the sort of trank weapons and their restrictions. It's like...
There's a mission early on. This is a very minor spoiler technically, I suppose, but not really. Quiet is not initially part of your crew. And so she comes to attack you and you can choose to kill her or subdue her. And they say that at the start of the mission. And she's off like hiding up on cliff faces sniping at you and she can like one or two shot you with a sniper rifle.
And when they tell me that you can kill or subdue her, I started thinking about old school MGS. And in old school MGS... If you shot someone with a gun, and that's how you won the boss fight, they'd die.
Exactly. And so the first, like, five attempts I had at this mission, I'm thinking, like, I've got to sneak up on her and use my trank pistol, or I've got to get a close quarters combat takedown on her. No, you just shoot her in the head with a gun until she stops getting back up, and then you can choose to put handcuffs on her or... put a bullet in her head.
Yeah.
It's right at the end that you make the decision. Up until that point, you're just literally shooting her with lethal weapons.
And especially when the game is trying to establish this kind of like semi-realistic operating world.
Yeah.
You know, where guards notice things and there's a little bit of that actual intelligence and feedback. It just really got on my nerves.
And, you know, in fairness, she is a superhero. She does have superpowers, but like I didn't even attempt shooting her until, like I said, the fourth or fifth time I tried that mission.
Yeah.
So there was some communication issues there.
Yeah.
The other thing that's very different from this one is the open world. We'll keep this pretty brief because open, it's about the loosest definition of an open world I think you can get. There are five or six major points in each. There are two continents you go to. You go to Afghanistan, you go to somewhere in Africa. I don't know if they ever say this specific country. But you have these two maps that you can go to, and there's about six locations of actual note and level design finesse, and the rest of it is just flat desert or flat marshland.
Ooh. Very simple camps that act as checkpoints.
There's like the most basic little like, oh, here's a soldier checkpoint. There's four guards there and a tower. So the world is very, very sparse and getting around it is very boring. D-horse and driving vehicles are serviceable, but nothing more than serviceable. So you don't want to explore the world when you can just jump on a chopper and have the chopper take you there. And it's a lot more cinematic and cool anyway.
So the most annoying thing I found was that when you're in Mother Base, you can use the chopper to move around different points.
Yeah.
But when you're in a level, you have to go out of it and back in.
Yeah, that's very frustrating. Like, you have to go back up to your command center and then choose a drop point.
And your command center is just your helicopter. It just flies really high.
And what I think is also kind of disappointing about that is...
it's segmented by loading screens as well.
It's loading screens and everything. But if you call in a chopper to take you back to the aerial command center, which is so, like, the aerial command center is just like a... When you're sitting in the chopper and you're not really anywhere in the world, right? Yeah. You can call in a chopper and it costs you 7,000 monies to do it.
Or
you can go to the pause screen and go, take me back to the AAC. And gameplay function-wise, they're identical. But if you could do what you were saying, where you could actually jump on the chopper and have it take you there, and it doesn't require any loading screens, and it doesn't require, like, you to re-choose your deployment outfit, because every time you deploy, you have to pay for all of the equipment you deploy with. Very cool. I love the idea, but it would have been nice if the chopper could just take me there with the gear I already had.
Sometimes it was just like, I just want to get across the map. I don't want to drive there.
Yeah. And these little things, like if the world was more fun to explore or the chopper actually flew you over the world and, you know, you could see all these different camps as you flew over them, it would make the world feel a lot bigger and a lot more varied, because there are some parts of the maps that are very interesting, but about 80% of it is just flat land, really.
Admittedly, I can recall a lot of the locations. Like, they do come to mind, but they're not overly exciting.
And they're just not that three-dimensional either. Like, you'll have a couple of levels that'll be sort of three stories tall, but it's not like there's a couple of mountains in the middle of the map that you have to navigate around or anything like that. the terrain is somewhat featureless in some ways.
Actually, in Afghanistan, near the north, in the mountain areas, there are some impassable mountains that are incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, but they're also only so tall, and they're more just like impassable areas rather than they are like an actual feature of the terrain.
That's a great point. It's like a zone. Like,
yeah, it doesn't feel alive in the way that like The Witcher 3 world feels alive.
Or like Breath of the Wild.
Oh, fucking Breath of the Wild, the gold fucking star for that. Like, I hate Bethesda's open worlds. I don't find them enticing at all. Mm-hmm. They are leagues ahead of what Metal Gear Solid 5 offers in the open world, kind of.
It's just because they've got interesting things in them.
Yeah. And there's people and stuff. It's very, very bland.
I think it's just a problem when they just commit to that aesthetic of that realistic aesthetic a little bit too much. But it
doesn't feel realistic in a lot of places. Like, I said, when I'm talking about large flat stretches of land, it's not like, okay, you're on this flat stretch of land and there's a slight incline and the bottom right corner of the map is actually probably much lower down than the top left corner. No, it's perfectly flat. Like, they loaded up the basic template for a grid level and just put grass on top of it.
Yeah.
Like, so, and none of the water is anything other than ankle deep, because you need to be able to lie down in it. And it's just, there's just so much that stops the world feeling real and three-dimensional and tangible in the same way as, like, some of the weapons and the helicopters and stuff do. And
it really bums me out when, like, the rest of the game has this one... like, when you're doing missions and you're going through the zones that it sets you, that feels really great. But the second you have to jump to that open world, the full open world thing, just kind of falls apart.
Exactly. And, like, they put a lot of effort into these little areas. I think that they were fine.
As soon as the game curates the levels, right, you can see where this is
a massive change in quality of the of the design when you go to any of the places where an actual mission will be set.
It almost makes me wish that the game had been like the older ones and been a little bit more linear.
Yeah, it might have been more compelling, you know?
I don't know. I think it's serviceable.
Yeah. If it's fine, and the parts where you're actually doing shit is pretty good for the most part. We'll talk briefly about the narrative structure as well, because there are also a couple of depth problems I have with that.
Mm.
So the themes of this game are fucking amazing. And I say amazing. The caliber is very, very present.
Like you said at the start, it's like surprising almost.
Yeah, yeah. What we're going to talk about here, we'll try and also keep this spoiler free. This is more about the technique, like the narrative technique they use. So the game is mostly done through cutscenes and audio recordings.
Yep.
Be those audio things like actual recordings that you have on cassette tape or exposition that's given to Snake over the radio during a mission.
Mm-hmm.
It's very confusing a lot of the time to keep that shit straight. Like, it's so bizarre to me that, like, you'll have a mission with Miller and he'll talk about revenge and the Diamond Dogs and say the phrase Diamond Dogs like 9 times in a cutscene and how we're Diamond Dogs and the Diamond Dogs have the Diamond Dogs back and all this kind of thing.
Diamond Dogs!
But then really crucial plot elements, like which shell corporations are operating as fronts for which secret agencies and who we're fighting for and who we're fighting against, become incredibly muddy because it's all just thrown at you through dialogue exposition.
Yep.
And there are some advantages to that when you're getting a game that's being translated, because if you just have dialogue over the radio, you don't have to lip sync, you don't have to keep the sound bites to a particular length, you have a lot more freedom in the translation.
Well, also, and the original Metal Gear games, they had the codec, which was literally like a whole bunch of radio stations you could go to at any time to call in and talk to support operators.
Right.
So in the older games, you would just go on your codec, which was your magical radio where no one could hurt you. And then you could listen and call in to all of your support team.
Right.
So that's probably why the tapes are so heavily used, because
it's like a sort of like a holdover from previous games.
It's like a bridge into trying to move it into this game.
For the most part, I did follow the narrative, right? Like, I understood that who Skullface was. I didn't really understand what our beef was from because I haven't played, like, Peace Walker or anything like this. There's a lot of history I was missing. And a lot of that is presented in these cassette tapes. And how many hours would you say?
I mean, like, 300, 400 hours?
Yeah,
it is
impenetrable. And this is kind of my fault a little bit, but also I feel like the game could have communicated this to me better. I made a decision early on that I didn't want to sit down and listen to the audio cassettes, because I've played Mass Effect and read every single codex entry, and I thought, you know, I'm very blind on this game anyway. I may as well just keep being blind and see how well I follow it all. There are some cassettes that are highlighted with a golden icon rather than a silver one, and those are plot critical ones that you need to listen to fully understand what's going on. And I didn't know that until like 80% of the way through the game.
The game has what I would call a pretty good hint system in sort of conveying information through in loading screens.
Mm.
I don't think that was one of them though.
Yeah, I don't remember reading that anywhere. And when I saw it in the mission screen, because there are some missions or side ops that are highlighted in the same way, that gold ones are story critical and you got to play them, silver ones are optional. I picked it up pretty quickly, but I don't remember that for the missions being communicated to me either explicitly. So I could have had a better idea of what was going on if I'd sat down and dedicated more time to listening to those tapes, but Metal Gear Solid already has a reputation of being a cutscene-heavy, low-player-control series, in just the stuff I was doing, I was feeling it, although I imagine it's much better in this than it was in previous games.
You have no idea. MGS4, I think, is like the cornerstone of, you should have just made a movie.
Yeah.
Why didn't you make movies? Honestly, many cutscenes. I love them, but over the top.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
like, definitely. The only reason I got through those cassettes is I had wireless headphones for my PC, and I would walk into the other room and sit on the couch and do something else.
Listening to it like a podcast. Yeah. And see, I thought about that as well. I thought, like, you know, maybe I can just set up my PC, turn the speakers up a little bit louder than I normally would, and get other shit done while listening to all of these recordings, but you've got to go back in and queue up the next tape every like 5 minutes.
It's broken into like segments weirdly. Mm. Yeah. I, I wasn't a super fan.
Yeah, it wasn't ideal. And there's also elements in the cutscenes as well that it does have, especially in the cutscenes, you notice that Japanese style of shooting where there's a lot more air left between lines of dialogue, and it just makes the whole interaction feel very, a little bit more floaty and a little bit less punchy than we're used to in the West.
Yes, that's true.
Which also, for me, makes it a little bit harder to follow it because all the body language and stuff doesn't tie in quite so much to the dialogue, if that makes sense. Like, I have to get like 90% of the information just from the words people are saying. I think that's why I had so much trouble following the story. Do you want to talk about some characters now? Do you want to talk about Quiet in more depth?
Most of the characters, they feel kind of one-dimensional.
Yeah, I would say that's fair.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, especially because the whole series is so big that over the scope of the whole series, they become real well-rounded.
Yeah.
And no one game betrays. I think Quiet's the standout one that kind of really comes up, especially because of the pre-game discussion around it.
Yeah, and her depiction. So I will just say something very quickly about, because you mentioned the characters are all very one-dimensional. I'm not an expert on, like, Eastern storytelling, but another impression that I have is that character-focused pieces aren't as popular in Eastern cinema and in Eastern storytelling as they are in Western storytelling. We have a much more individualist focus, and I feel that all of the characters in this are more important for how they service and represent the themes of the piece than they are for their own personal journeys and emotional growth through the piece. So you are right, they are very one-dimensional, but I think that their purpose is more about exploring themes like revenge and exploring themes like language and that kind of thing.
I'm obsessed with a podcast about the works of Kurt Vonnegut, and when you hear them talk about how he writes characters, they're basically just tools to explain his themes.
Yeah.
Like you said. So yeah, that kind of makes sense to me. Now, the more you think about it, they all kind of represent different archetypes and...
Yeah, and they play into like the stuff the game's playing around with. Quiet in particular though, you are right, is probably the one who we can talk the most about. So Quiet was noted very early on for wearing basically nothing, and the game got a lot of flack for that, and Kojima came out and said, oh no, but wait till you play the game because you'll understand there's a very good reason why she dresses like that.
And I feel like that was like... Why'd you say that?
Yeah, that just made it worse.
Yeah, right. Because now you're setting up an expectation for us to be, oh, we're going to be wrong. That's going to be a reason. It'll make perfect sense.
Yeah. Quiet, of course, breathes through her skin because she has this parasitic infection that gives her superpowers. All of that's not super important. I should probably also mention we are definitely going to start moving into spoiler territory very soon. So thank you for joining us if you're...
It's a spoiler-free.
If you're a spoiler-free listener.
Sorry to tell you that... Just Quiet has parasites in her.
But... Yeah, but I mean, everybody knows that Quiet has, like, supernatural abilities.
And then she breathes through her skin.
Yeah, she breathes through her skin. So she breathes through her skin. She also photosynthesizes, so she needs direct sunlight exposure. Those are the in-game narrative lies for why she dresses the way she dresses.
They're technically not lies. They're just, like, thinly veiled
excuses. John made the, like... There's this concept of the diegetic argument, like that the in-universe, there are in-universe explanations for why a thing is why it is, and so we should just accept it as out-of-universe audience members. That isn't necessarily a compelling thing, right? Mm-hmm. If somebody says it's, as a criticism of Game of Thrones, for example, the way they depict sexual violence is problematic and upsetting to me, and somebody's response is, oh yeah, but it's a really dark world and rape happens all the time. That doesn't actually address the initial criticism.
Yeah.
Right? You saying that the writers hand-waved an explanation in there doesn't help. And so this is what this is for Quiet dressing the way that she does. Something I think is incredibly important to mention though. Even though yes, clothing breathes, and even though yes, a person wearing clothes from the neck down doesn't mean their face is not exposed, or there are different versions of clothing like this that is a little bit more practical, but still allows a lot of skin to be exposed to breathe or whatever. Even despite all of those diegetic counters to the diegetic argument, Quiet's clothes aren't the problem. They're a symptom of the problem.
Mm.
Fishnet stockings and a bikini halter top or whatever are totally fine.
Yeah,
like, me trying to tell Quiet that she can't wear that is just as misogynistic as somebody insisting that she has to.
You're absolutely right. There's nothing wrong with wearing that.
Yeah.
In fact, people wear things like that all the time. It is totally fine.
The problem is evident in so many other ways, though. Like, whenever the camera is on quiet, it is positioned in such a way that her breasts are in shot, and in a very gratuitous, deliberate, here is the focal point of the shot way.
Actually, David, you're not right there. It's not always her breasts. Sometimes it's her ass.
Fair point.
Yeah.
That is a fair criticism. I retract my previous statement.
66% to 33%, you know, yeah. Tits versus ass.
When she's on the field with you, she's just a character who's doing her shit, right? Like, yeah. you don't have that control of the camera to force that. But whenever
it's
you're in
those brief moments when you leave the helicopter and just before you get on it.
Yeah.
Because when you get onto the helicopter, she's then exposed to your pleasure.
Yeah. So you sit on the side of the helicopter, she jumps up and she stands on the skid and hangs off the side of the chopper. And even though you have control of the camera, she's clearly positioned in such a way that her breasts are supposed to be in the primary focus of what you can see. Any of the cutscenes do it. Whenever she picks up a gun or whenever you have a close-up on her hand, her boobs are right behind it. And
any? All.
All cutscenes. Literally every single one.
Even the torture scene.
Yes. Like, what the fuck? Like, there's a scene where, like, Wyatt gets tortured for information because you think she's a spy. And even in this scene that's so confronting, they're still like, super naked though, good boobs, right? And this isn't like some meta thing. This isn't them leveraging the male gaze to make you go, it's fucked up that you enjoy this or something like that. You know, there's nothing beyond just the same pervy camera operator that they've had the whole game.
How does that guy keep his job? Like, I swear, anytime a woman appears on screen, I mean, actually, now that I mention it, Quiet's like the only real female character in the game.
Yes, she is. Like, there is a smaller female character, and we've already said spoilers.
Yeah.
Spoiler warning's been issued. Paz makes a minor appearance, but not in any kind of narratively significant way.
And she's also very missable.
Yeah, she's completely optional. Like, it's an Easter egg. Basically. There is something else about Quiet that I think is very unfortunate, and that is in her behavior towards Venom Snake.
Yeah.
Because as the bond level increases, her behavior in the helicopter changes as well. Like, she starts to, like, fawn over you a little bit, and she acts a lot, like, the body language is very dog-like. You know, she's often sort of kneeling and, like, on her knees and hunched over, and when she's looking at you inquisitively, like, examining you, it's very tilted head, and it's very, I was made quite uncomfortable by that.
I was gonna say, what you said is uncomfortable, but that's literally what happens. Like, you're right. Like, all those looks, it's like, because she never vocalizes, and they just play around with her physicality, it just comes across really awkwardly.
But there's a really great cutscene very early on with Quiet where you know, this is right after you capture and put her on the thing and the jet comes in to shoot down the chopper. You have this whole cutscene where, again, there's a way too many boob shots, right? But she's badass as fuck. It isn't gratuitous. It isn't extended. She just has this, I'm here. I saved your life. Because, like, she's supposed to be a prisoner, but she gets out of her handcuffs, picks up a sniper rifle, and shoots the jet out of the sky.
She shoots the pilot in the jet as it attacks your helicopter. She's badass.
And it's awesome. It's fucking sick, right? Almost, it's like, the coolest thing ever.
There's, like, brief moments there from when she appears to when she disappears that are, like, badass.
Yeah. And she, you know, after she shoots it down, she sits in one of the chairs, she cycles the bolt on the sniper rifle to get all of the rounds out of it, passes it back to Snake, and then puts her handcuffs back on.
Yep.
And the body language in all of that, it's so effective without being submissive, you know what I mean? And I wish that they'd found ways to communicate that, like, she trusts Snake in a way that isn't like, I'm a loyal pet.
Yes. You know, I get what you mean. It's like when they spend every shot sexualizing her, like that, in that aggressive, kind of uncomfortable, one directional way, it just works against them. There's nothing inherently wrong with, like, the character as it's presented.
Yeah.
It's just portrayed.
And the concept of someone who needs to have their skin exposed to survive.
Yeah.
In, like, a hard sci-fi, I can imagine that being a very interesting and very well explored concept. Here it is clearly just a hand wave to have her boobs exposed.
She's so cool as well. She's my favorite buddy. Like, I just loved using her. And I just got really mad just of how she was portrayed.
Mm.
And, you know, it also doesn't help that she's the only female character in the cast and she doesn't speak.
And that ties in very nicely to us moving into themes. So another really obvious criticism of Quiet is that she is, quote unquote, quiet. Yep. She does not speak for the vast majority of the game. And so there's elements of like silencing the only female character you have in the piece, all of that kind of thing. I'm less critical of her not speaking than I am of her sexual objectification, because the sexual objectification serves no narrative or thematic purpose. But there are a lot of themes in this game that are very interesting and so far up my alley that, like, I want to at least contextualize quiet silence as part of that.
I never expected it. And then when it came up, I was like, oh, David's going to love this.
Yeah. So there are a couple of major themes in the game, and we'll probably start with the one that's most relevant to quiet. And that is the idea of language being a coercive tool of propaganda. Mm. So Skullface is the main enemy in the game, and he's all about eradicating
the English language, isn't it?
The English language very specifically, but there's also a number of other languages that he's interested in coercing. Basically, his backstory is when he was relatively young, his people were exterminated, mm. and he was the sole surviving person, but his language that he learnt as a child was wiped from the face of the earth. And so he had to learn to speak English instead. And he talks about how the opening quote, I'm going to read it here because it's a very powerful quote. This flashes up before the start of the game. "It is no nation we inhabit, but a language. Make no mistake, our native tongue is our true fatherland." And that's a quote by Emil Cioran, a Romanian philosopher. And that is a theme that's explored very heavily through the game, that a person's ideology and a person's motivations and thought processes are all influenced by the language that they speak,
mm.
both as sort of like a fundamental code through which to view the world, like a system of disseminating information, but also as a tool of propaganda.
I mean, I've read heaps of studies and watched many YouTube videos explaining like how language can gender things and
yeah.
affect people's ways of thinking.
There was a Stephen Fry documentary on this, and I'm going to butcher the actual facts, but the point is salient. There was a woman who was talking about how she's trilingual. She speaks English, French, and I think Czechoslovakian. And she was talking about how in Czech, bridges are gendered feminine, but in French, they're gendered masculine.
Yeah.
And if you ask a French person to describe a bridge, they use terms like strong, and they have a broad span, and they're feats of engineering. Whereas in Czech, they'll talk about them being elegant and architectural and sweeping. And they use like just little things about how we understand language. I was reading a piece a while ago about how if you're multilingual, if you've learnt your second language later in life, you experience fewer cognitive biases when thinking in that language. Mm. So as a very basic example, the word prostitute is something that describes a profession in the English language. And even though that's the proper word for someone who works in that particular line of sex work, it's a very loaded word. Like,
yes.
It's like just me saying the word prostitute, I feel like I'm being pejorative or using negative language,
yeah.
even though it is the appropriate term for someone who works in that role in the sex industry.
I can think of several words to use as examples, but I don't want to say any of them out loud.
Yeah, and so there are obviously worse examples of that, but even one of the least loaded words is still quite loaded in English. But if I knew a word for prostitute in another language, I don't have the cultural background of being brought up in that language to ascribe so much as the emotional tie to that word. So this is all sort of external to Metal Gear Solid 5, but language as this tool is very, very central to the plot. They talk about English being the lingua franca of the world and what power that gives to the West
yep.
as a political force in the world.
It parallels how America sometimes forces people to use their currency in business transactions.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and so, like, the game, for something that's been translated from another language, has an amazing number of these great, very resonant quotes. And one of the things that Skullface says to describe his goal is he's looking for a world sans lingua franca. And there's something that's just, like, I heard that, I'm just like, I'm in love with it. I love every part of this. This is great. And so, quiet and her lack of speech is part of this thematic exploration,
yeah.
right? One of the main plot elements is a parasite that infects a person's vocal cords and can be programmed to react only to the sound of a specific language. So you can have a parasite that's coded towards the English language, for example, and it might infect someone who speaks Spanish and German, but it won't hurt them at all mm. because it doesn't, like, actually harm their body unless they speak the English language. But if you have someone who speaks Spanish and English as the secondary language, they will be hurt by it whenever they speak English.
Yep.
And, you know, Skullface's whole plan is to use that as the true ethnic cleanser.
That's uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable, but it talks about, like, look, it's not about eliminating ethnicity based on genetics. It's not about skin tone. It's about eliminating a process of thought,
ooh,
you know, which is a very cool idea.
Because, like, that's languages can influence our thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. And it's in a way, it's very true. Like, I, as an English-speaking Australian, I probably have a lot more in common than an American and a Canadian and a British person than I would with even a German, even though that German person is part of the Western world.
Mm.
And that's got to do with, like, exporting media as well. And that's another way that America has been a dominant force. You talked about currency before, but the exportation of American media.
Yeah.
Is a cultural influence on the world. And before America, it was France. France was the major exporter of, like, art and culture and media in the world before America. And that was part of why they were such a high point. If you go back to the Renaissance, you have England, but more importantly, Italy, exporting culture around the world and how that makes them this economic and political power force. And so these themes of language are fucking fascinating to me.
I wish I could describe how excited David looks right now. This is sometimes the thing you'll encounter in a Metal Gear Solid game. They'll have these themes that are just so interesting.
Mm.
And, like, that's such, what an interesting, like, motivation for a villain to have.
Yeah.
Right?
And we talk about Skullface being interesting. Again, thematically, incredibly interesting. On the character development level, actually kind of one-dimensional and dull.
Yeah.
You know, he's driven by revenge. He wants to wipe out English. Like, he doesn't really evolve over the course of the game.
And revenge is a big thing that is all throughout this game. Everybody wants revenge all the time.
Yeah. If we go back to Quiet as well, like, Quiet has a number of people she wants revenge against. And I just want to very briefly tie up that point I was making about why I'm not super critical of Quiet saying nothing.
All right, go ahead.
Thanks, John. That's been very valuable.
I didn't mean to say it like that. I apologize.
That's totally fine. The thing with Quiet being speechless, like I said, because of all of these themes, it has narrative significance, and she adopts this role as somebody who exists outside of that linguistic system of control. Mm. It isn't just "be quiet, woman, the men are talking," and I think that that's a reductive way to view her as a character.
I agree. I just, the only thing is, you only learn that through the game, and if you're paying attention to the themes,
yeah, right?
And, like, I know from experience that sometimes you don't pay attention to themes.
Mm. And there's also a point that the character that existed outside this system of language control does not have to be a woman. That said, though, silence is a major form of oppression, and so any other intersectional identity beneath that, there is going to be that implication. Like, if you had a black man and the black man was like, "I don't speak," again, that's going to be a massive problem for other historical reasons.
I just think that sometimes a diversity of cast can let you spread this stuff around.
Fair point.
And if you had multiple characters who potentially didn't speak, I understand that that has other narrative implications.
The simpler way to do it would be to have other women who do speak.
Yeah.
You have Quiet who doesn't speak. If you've got two more women in the piece, suddenly it's not the only woman in the game is completely silent. Like,
yeah, it's just uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah. But I have interrupted you far too many times. Please, John, talk about revenge.
Revenge. I think the game sets up the revenge theme super early.
Yeah.
In the first sort of chapter, when the codenames of yourself and your quote-unquote protector are revealed as, was it Abraham and Ishmael?
Ahab and Ishmael.
Excuse me.
To any of the people who not as fast on the pickup of that, Moby Dick is, that's a very, very, very explicit and on the nose reference to Moby Dick.
And I haven't read Moby Dick, but I'm going to assume it's about revenge.
Yeah, well, you know what Moby Dick's
yeah,
about, right?
It's about a man who's so driven by revenge of this whale that he kills himself and his crew.
Yeah, possessed by fervor for hunting the whale. Yeah.
The whale that took his leg.
Oh, is it?
I don't know. I haven't read it.
Yeah. It's a close enough approximation that it's a fitting analogy.
And just everyone wants to get revenge on everyone. I could almost list every character apart from, like, Ocelot.
Ocelot kind of wants revenge, I think.
True. But, like, almost all the characters are driven by revenge.
Yeah.
It's like Miller just goes on and on about Diamond Dogs and reclaiming their glory. And you know, I can't think of a single character that isn't driven by it.
Yeah, so you want revenge against Skullface because he blew up Mother Base in Ground Zeroes.
Yes.
Skullface wants revenge against the Diamond Dogs for some reason, maybe because they used to be with the CIA, but he wants revenge for against a bunch of people.
He wants revenge against Cypher, which is the American organization.
Okay, yeah. And he's with XOF, who used to work for Cypher. It's not important. He wants revenge.
It's so much plot, not important.
The thing that they clearly establish very, very quickly is that every act of violence against a group inspires retaliation, even to the point where that is a gameplay mechanic of the multiplayer. So you build these bases and you can infiltrate other players' bases.
Yeah.
If you do that, you pop up on the top of their list as like a rival who's just infiltrated. So where every time you infiltrate another base to try and take something, you invite retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting to see that theme carry over into the multiplayer of the game.
The multiplayer is very interesting, although I haven't experienced
it. Yeah, I didn't play too much of it because there was some criticisms of like how frustrating it could be and blah, 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 blah. You've also got the characters of the Man on Fire, who is Volgen. Volgen, who is a character from a previous game who wants revenge against Snake.
Not going to get into it, but yes.
And he's literally a burning human who destroys everything that he touches. And yep. Again, we talk about this theme of retaliation. Every attack against him makes him stronger. Like every yeah. bullet that hits him, every grenade or whatever makes him burn more bright and more furiously. Then you've obviously got Eli as well, mm-hmm. who is driven by, I don't know what exactly
I don't know. It gets real vague.
Yeah, but he has the most powerful theme of revenge.
It doesn't make much. I don't know.
Yeah, cause there's like, the third boy is a character that appears in this and they're basically like this ghost. We'll just call him a ghost.
He's a person, but he's magically psychic.
Yeah, he's a psychic person.
He does pass through the walls, so he's ghost-like.
If there's something, they explain this in one of the tapes, but he feeds parasitically off the emotions of other people, right? He doesn't experience them himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'll latch on to the person who's feeling the most intense emotion in the area, and it's always the person who wants the worst revenge, and then they always commit violence, and then somebody else wants more revenge than them, and so the third boy goes to them. So it sounds very trite, and John made a comment before we started here, like there's so much media, be it Star Wars or what any other child focused thing, that talks about how retaliation and revenge are bad things, that we've already been programmed
To sort of program to understand that it's bad.
Yeah.
On an individual level.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you raised a very good point that geopolitically and in the larger world, there are still people out there committing violent acts for revenge.
Yes. And, like, I mean, you obviously have Palestine and Israel. ISIS is fueled by retaliatory motivation. And every time we do something to curtail ISIS or to marginalize Muslim people in our own communities, that just makes ISIS stronger because they feed off that desire for revenge, you know? And so geopolitically, it still is a very major thing that requires discussion. And so it's cool to see that both allegorically and literally explored in Metal Gear Solid.
Definitely.
One of the other sort of themes that they explore is this idea of military honor.
Oh.
So another really great single standalone line is, I'm going to mispronounce this, but Militares Sans Frontiers, which is Big Boss's mercenary company, Soldiers Without Borders. And like, you hear that and it's so ridiculous, but it's such an upsettingly compelling idea, right? Like the transgression of Doctors Without Borders into this horrifying thing, you know?
And I think it comes into more focus as you realize that maybe you're not the good guys.
Yeah.
And as the game goes on, you're like, are we just torturing people and murdering people and doing all these things?
Because, like, for me as a new player, I don't know what Big Boss's whole deal is. I don't know if he's, like, an anti-hero, where, like, he's supposed to be dark and upsetting, but he's still doing good things for the wrong reasons or something like that.
Yeah.
Or whether he is just a remorseless villain and shit like that. And so when I'm playing this, I'm exploring this as well and going through, like, the morality of Big Boss. And this idea of, again, we talk about like the poisonous ideology of governments and nations, which in this is sort of ascribed to language a lot of the time. Big Boss's like goal is to create an army free of the ideology of nations, this pure expression of military honor.
Which is kind of gross.
Yeah, it's kind of fucked up. That, like,
you think about it longer and you're like, oh yeah, you know, soldiers, they can go wherever they want. They can fight in any war for any person for money, wherever they're needed to commit violence. This doesn't sound like a good thing.
And there are, in the real world, private military companies that do that. They will take contracts from people, from governments, from NGOs, and go to a place and commit violence for money. Like, that's a real thing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they're contracted by even people who are on, quote, our side. You know, it is a business. And so when you're looking at what Big Boss is trying to build, there's the element of, like, okay, the real world reflection of that that's kind of, and then there's this concept of warfare for warfare's sake, like the honor of the soldier. And this is one of the things I found very interesting starting the game off. There are so many cutscenes that are quite dark that involve torture, and like they don't pretty up the world. Like there's that, the very opening mission is you're going through that hospital and you have these people coming through trying to assassinate, Venom Snake, and they're shooting up
patients and doctors.
Yeah. And the way that they depict the, what am I trying to say? The injuries of the bullets, right? It isn't just like bang and the person drops like a stormtrooper. You know, one bullet doesn't kill a person. They scream and they writhe and they...
Brutal.
Yeah, it's very brutal, and it sets the tone for what you're doing with your guns the rest of the game. But whenever you go to a loadout screen, it's just heroic brass trumpets. And every time you're talking to Miller, there's this mix of like, we need violent retaliation against the people who wronged us, and this honor of being one of the diamond dogs, a brotherhood of soldiers who stand side by side. And time someone dies, they have a heroic burial for them. And
yeah, it gets really weird when you realize a lot of your soldiers are brainwashed.
Yeah, and like
literally.
Because it's kind of ambiguous. Like, I didn't know, is it just that everybody's so in love with the legend of Big Boss? Or when I'm pulling someone out with my fucking balloon, are they being subjected to psychological warfare and turned to our side, you know?
Ocelot, I can't remember exactly, but I feel like Ocelot does convince, in air quotes, people to join.
Well, I mean, that's definitely true of Huey, right? He is held under duress very, very strongly. And when you capture people, sometimes they go to the brig for like a week and then they join you. But probably about 90% of the people you capture just straight up enlist in your organization.
And you do get volunteers as well.
Yeah. So I think it's a bit of a mix.
I know in some of the other games, that child, the third child, later becomes a character called Psycho Mantis, who's a magical psychic. And he is used to fill in the gaps between the soldiers. So all the soldiers kind of go to help Big Boss form this, I can't remember which game I'm talking about now. I think it's Metal Gear Solid 1. There's like a revolt with all these soldiers. Some of them willingly go, but the ones that don't are controlled by Psycho Mantis.
Right.
To join in.
Some of them are volunteers and some of them are psychically controlled.
Yeah. And I think in this, it's like some of them are being manipulated by whatever Ocelot does to them.
Yeah.
And Ocelot's like an ex-Russian GRU commando, and he's in the intel team with all kinds of tricks.
Yeah, there's a lot of scenes of torture in this game, and I don't think at any point they depict torture as noble. Unfortunately, more than once, they show it as being effective, which I think is misleading for the most part. I mean, most people in the humane intelligence community now understand that torture is useless because it just gets people to say what you want them to say, not what's actually true.
And what is it? In any circumstance where you know that someone knows something, you already know.
Yeah. So,
why do you torture them anyway?
That's a good point. Like,
torture only gets the truth that you know a person has out of them.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point.
As far as I know, from my uneducated knowledge. But yeah.
I'm going to go on the record and say, even with my very limited level of knowledge, torture's a bad thing. Let's stop doing it, please.
The point I was trying to make is, I don't know if torture, even in that situation, is actually effective. That was the point I was making.
Right.
I would also agree that torture is very bad and morally reprehensible.
And so when we're talking about this idea of military honor and like the nobility of what you're doing, Ocelot and Miller are both morally gray at best. Miller is very much driven by revenge and violent retribution.
He's obsessed also with the cult of personality around Diamond Dogs and Big Boss too.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the other thing too. Like, a lot of people are in love with this legend of Big Boss, which...
Have you walked around the base?
Yeah, they say, like, give us a sparring match and all that kind of thing.
You beat the shit out of your soldiers on the base, and they go, thanks, boss.
Yeah, when they get up, they thank you for beating them and for shooting them in their head with a tranq rifle. You can't kill any of them, but...
It just feels weird.
Yeah, and there's a lot of this deification of Big Boss, but beyond just that, there is still this idea that warfare is inherently noble, and I don't... It's so interesting to wonder where the critique lies in this. I mean, there's a very simple, dismissive way of the thing people say about being pro-soldier, anti-war, which I think is massively oversimplified because soldiers are victims of war. And so to separate the nobility of one half of that, I think, messes up how intrinsically related those problems are, you know? But... in this particular game, it's very difficult to see what the ideology is about war when some of the ideology about some of the other stuff, like language and all that kind of thing, is much clearer.
Yeah. Now I think about it, it kind of reminds me of honor, like the idea of honor in the traditional kind of sense.
Yeah.
Is the loyalty and...
I mean, you have the heroism resource that you earn by being rad at war.
Yeah. And not getting seen and stuff like that. Overall, it just made me feel more and more uncomfortable as I played.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that's a lot less ambiguous, though, as far as the way the game feels about it, is child soldiers.
Oh, yeah. That came out of nowhere.
So, there are some problems with how the issue of child soldiers is explored in Metal Gear Solid 5. It is literally the only... game that I can think of that goes anywhere near the topic, though.
Yeah.
And considering that fact, it does better in some ways than you might expect.
And actually, other games in the Metal Gear Solid franchise don't have depictions, but they do talk about characters being child soldiers, and it kind of brought up sometimes in okay ways, other times in really bad ways. See the Beauty and Beast Squad in MGS4? That's... messed up, and we're not getting into it now.
Yeah, I don't even know what you're talking about.
I do not want to rant for 20 minutes about...
We'll try and keep this quick, because we are definitely running long. The child soldiers in this appear pretty early on. They're sympathetically portrayed. So that's a good step in the right direction.
Thumbs
off
up.
The bat. That they are depicted as being children who have been conscripted and forced into this warfare, and when you're going in there to do particular missions that relate to child soldiers... you immediately fail the game if you kill any of them.
Yep.
So you immediately fail the mission if any child soldier comes to lethal harm. You can knock them out and you can sneak around them, but they are still depicted as being victims of the state of disorder and war in Central Africa and Southern Africa.
Yep.
There are some other problems with it, though. For one thing, when you save a group of child soldiers who are being held by adult soldiers who plan to conscript them, you take them back to your military corporation and put them to use. And the implication is, of course, they're not doing anything like frontline related, but they're probably, I would imagine, maintaining equipment and weapons and all of that kind of thing. They're still facilitating warfare.
Not to mention the fact that when they first meet, like when Miller first sees them, Venom Snake remarks that they're, you know, the kid has like good talent, or he's like,
yeah, Miller is like, these kids can't be here. We've got to get them off base. And one of them grabs a rifle and points it at Miller to be all like, don't come near me.
Yeah.
And Boss's comment is something like, see, the kids are natural.
Yeah.
Because of how well he holds this gun on you.
Just uncomfortable.
And admittedly, like we said, the moral nobility of Big Boss and the Diamond Dogs is called more explicitly into question later in the game. And so, in retrospect, I feel like this is perhaps also saying that he is still exploiting these people.
Yeah.
But there is also this like, oh, yeah, the kid's still strong because he knows how to kill people. Well, it's like, well, the whole problem is that a child has been taught how to do that.
Yeah.
That's not noble. That's not something that we should be admiring in this child, that they know how to hold a gun.
And, of course, that's something that Big Boss does admire.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why, you know, he's no better. He's just a different kind of villain.
Yeah. They also have a couple of explorations of the fact that the kids, even though they've been removed from the battlefield, in this case by Big Boss, but, you know, the real world analogy for that would be by, you know, some kind of NGO or government group or like aid group.
Yeah.
After being removed from the battlefield, they still kind of want to go back.
Yeah.
Which I think is, again, it's deeper than I would expect from something like this, where it's like, oh, you saved the kids. They're happy. They love you now. Well done. You did it.
Yeah.
But they still mention that there are these massive problems about how the children also, they want retaliation against the people who took them from their communities.
Yeah.
Or they want to fight alongside the people who conscripted them in the first place. Like, they all have, like, that disease of violence isn't just so easily removed from someone, even when they're still so young.
Yep. It comes back again. Yeah.
So, like I said, there are problems with it, but it's probably, like,
they tried.
This is my cynicism. They honestly tried, and they did something that is better than a lot of other things might have done.
Especially when you look at, like, the portrayal of Quiet as a character, you can see the depths to which they can not do very well. It just shows, like, what happens when they really put their minds to something and the depiction of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Was there anything else that you wanted to say about Metal Gear Solid 5?
Not really. As like an end to what I would call like the Metal Gear Solid franchise, which I am considering it an end. I do not care what comes next. Who knows? It fits together with the rest of the narrative, and it is a fun game to play. And I think the story is engaging.
I think that the narrative delivery method is suboptimal. And I think some of the gameplay elements that we've already talked about are less than perfect. But like you say, it's a fun game to play. It has a lot of thematic weight.
Yeah.
And after playing this, I really can see why people speak about Kojima with such reverence. Like, I haven't played any of the other ones, but I imagine that they are trying to bite off a similar amount and chew on it. And even though I can sit here and say, this didn't work out so great, or this isn't how I would have done it, it's still very compelling to see what I think is a genuine and honest attempt to talk about big stuff that games don't normally talk about.
Yeah. In all the Metal Gear games, there's always been themes about nuclear weapons and that countries and corporations and violence.
Yeah.
They've always had those themes running through them.
And it's very interesting as well to see a politically motivated series that has existed through the Cold War up until now. Mm. That's something else that's very interesting, because like all of the Metal Gear stuff, at least from my very distant perspective, to me seems like a very clear allegory about the nuclear arms race and disarmament.
Yeah, the Metal Gears are walking nuclear tanks.
Yeah,
that's the whole point.
And I haven't played the game, so I don't know how perfect the analogy is, but like
the tanks with nukes on them.
Yeah, to go from a place in, like, I think the first game came out in 87, I want to say.
Yeah, I can't remember the first.
And so that's the very tail end of the Cold War. And obviously, the Cold War is one of those things that hasn't really ended properly. But as far as, like, officially ending, it ended shortly after that. To go into a game that talks about near futurism and also goes back to talk about things like Afghanistan and talk about, like, the 60s and the state of the political world then, I think that there's, like I said, I admire the scope of that, and I admire that these themes are being discussed in this medium. I made a point early on where Kojima responded to criticism about having a female character in a previous game be subjected to torture by sexual violence.
Mm.
And there were many people who criticized that, and his response was that we're trying to make a game that talks about the horror of war, basically.
Mm.
And if we want games to be taken seriously as a cultural medium, we can't shy away from these darker topics. Now, I've not played the game with that depiction in it, so I can't comment on that specifically. But having played Metal Gear Solid 5, I think that the intent does exist in him to have serious conversations about this stuff.
Now, his execution, sometimes?
Oh, yeah. And this is perhaps something as well. It sounds like such a weak caveat. I'm not Japanese. Neither is John. Yeah. And so we can sit and talk about how different things are depicted narratively and stuff like that as well.
Yeah.
Some of that stuff is lost in translation. And some of the-
We're not cultural experts in Japanese.
And like, especially when we talk about how Quiet is depicted, that's going to be taken differently in Japan as it is here. That doesn't invalidate my reaction to Quiet, though.
Of course.
It limits its level of informedness, but it doesn't mean that for people in a Western world, that their discomfort at Quiet's depiction is invalid because you don't understand Japan.
We don't just shrug off traditional things that happen in all cultures, including our own, just because it's a different culture.
Yeah, exactly.
Keep that nice and generic.
Yeah, basically. Let's just put it like that. All I'm really trying to say here is pretty good. Yeah, I guess.
It's pretty good. And like, you can see it tries to do things. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't just want to fit into a game. It wants to be a fully fledged text. Mm,
I'm very interested in, what's his next game?
Death Stranding. I was going to mention that.
Yeah.
Super excited to see
because
what that's
also under a different studio. So I imagine
That's his own studio, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, so you think it's independent?
That's like him doing his own thing. I don't know if they're working.
It's going to be so fucking different, isn't it?
Yeah, who knows what it's going to be. I think it's going to be like a third person game similar to this, but I have no idea. If you look at any of the trailers, they're all insane.
Yeah.
Right? So who knows what will happen?
No, I'm definitely playing that after this. Do we want to talk about our next game?
Well, yeah, of course. Our next game is going to be Oxenfree.
So, John, what the fuck is Oxenfree?
It's a story. Ollie, Oxenfree is like a nursery rhyme.
Cool. What's the thing that you're going to make me do, though?
Well, it's a story video game, adventure game style thing where you play as a bunch of, I think it's British teenagers. And
okay.
You explore a world. And
I know nothing about it other than the name and that the extra credits people say it's good.
Yeah, it's a bit of spook stuff apparently, and it's a bit mystical, and it's very story based. I thought it'd be right up your alley.
So, yeah, it sounds like it should be pretty great.
Honestly, I don't know very much about it either. That's why I kind of picked it.
If you like what we do and want to hear that Oxenfree episode as well as all the others, you can hit us up on iTunes. We are the Slowpokes Podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Search for us on there. Ratings and reviews are massively helpful for growth. So for any of you who feel like you want to take the time to do that, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, you need to feed those algorithms with the thumbs up and everything. Just go to slowpokespodcast.com and everything will be there, including whatever nonsense we're posting.
You can also hit us up at slowpokescast on Twitter or facebook.com/slowpokespodcast.
That's where you can ask us questions. We'll talk to us. We'll be talking to you because we want to hear what you have to say.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, everyone, for this, I imagine, will be somewhat longer episode.
Yeah. Good luck, David.
We'll see you next time for our fast cast and after that for Oxenfree.
Oxenfree. See ya.